Welcome to Nerds at Church, a queer feminist podcast diving deep into faith, nerdery, and the Bible. I'm Pastor Kay, and I use pronouns like she and her.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and my pronouns are they, them, theirs. In this, our first episode of Season 4, we will discuss ancient cosmology.
Yay!
Woohoo!
Check out the episode description for links to any references we make in this episode.
So, cosmology. What even is it? There's a couple words that come up when we talk about cosmology that could be confusing. The first is the word cosmology. What even is that? And there are actually two definitions of cosmology. One is that it is a branch of philosophy dealing with the origin and general structure of the universe. And the second definition is that it is a branch of astronomy dealing with the structure and evolution of the universe. So I think that that's really interesting because I guess the ancient philosophers we hear about a lot were also astronomers and astronomers philosophers. But I like that part of how we think about the origins of everything in the structure of the universe is by casting our gaze upon the stars.
Absolutely.
And cosmogony is another word that you might hear some, and that is the theory of the origin of the universe or creation slash the origin of the world or universe. So it's either the theory of or it is the origin of the universe, world, creation, cosmos.
Sure.
Whole big thing. So we don't use that word as much, but if you're digging deep into cosmology, you will probably come across the word cosmogony. You will probably not come across the word cosmetology because that is about makeup and
aesthetics.
Face and aesthetics of human being.
Yes.
So just to like clarify that a little bit. Yeah. So in this episode, we're looking from a philosophic, astronomic type perspective at the way that the whole cosmos is structured, which also involves how it came to be. There are more cosmologies than we could ever possibly list. And that's mostly because most cultures have at least one cosmology of their own. So instead of trying to name them all, we're doing more of a kind of survey overview of different ones from around the world. And what does this have to do with Epiphany, you ask? Well, understanding the universe and making sense of or figuring out how it is structured is part of the work of astronomy, and stargazers is one of the words used to describe the magi. And so also, since many cosmologies have to make sense of the sun and the moon and the stars, diving into them in a season that begins with magi following a star is quite fitting. Also, we are not diving deep into the cosmology that involves the Big Bang Theory because we've already done that. And we will link to our episode from season one on the Big Bang. And we'll link to it both on our regular podcast and also on YouTube for those of you who want or need captions.
Yes, and that episode is on the scientific theory of the Big Bang and not the TV show The Big Bang Theory, which I have actually not seen.
True. I have seen all of The Big Bang Theory TV show, and the episode is much more fun and has less misogyny.
Yeah, I think you could say that about a lot of our episodes, that we have less misogyny about than a lot of TV. I would hope so.
I don't know. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right. So as we jump into this, I'll start with a few African cosmologies. And before we start talking about cosmologies from the African continent, I'd like to point out that it can be difficult to be certain of how accurate our current understandings of these cosmologies from ancient African cultures are, because various colonialist cultures, as well as the faiths of Christianity and Islam, were often the ones who were recording these cultures and peoples. And keeping in mind that if a person is writing down another person's view of the universe in order to insult it on purpose, which was a common motive for why they were writing these things down many years ago, then not only is accuracy not very important to you while you're writing this down, but also it's very likely that the account is exaggerated or changed on purpose to make it more ridiculous. And because many of these ancient cultures and legends were so thoroughly attacked and intentionally erased by people with that intention, we are not actually sure how accurate what we have left is. I would also point out mm-hmm. that we're going to be talking about some Native American cosmologies later, and they have similar issues. But several of the original cultures of the Native Americans have managed to survive in some form to the current day in a stronger sense, since it took much longer for those colonialist cultures to get to the Americas than it did take them to get to Africa. And, I mean, let's also keep in mind, that's without even starting to account for how the recorder's own cosmology would change their understanding of what they're hearing from a person with a completely different background as well.
Truth. So, grain of salt.
Yeah.
All the things.
Lots of them. And I will also throw out there that, yes, Egypt is on the continent of Africa. However, it is super easy to go out there and find out the Egyptian theories of cosmology and ancient legends. And you can totally do that, no problem. Much easier than most of the rest of the continent of Africa. And so I'm not going to talk about those today. And instead, we'll focus on three African cultures: the Yoruba of Western Africa, the Maasai of Eastern Africa, and the Congo of Central Africa. So when we talk about the Yoruba of West Africa, primarily from what is now called Nigeria, the central deity Olodumare rules over the spiritual and physical realms and also created the universe, including many lesser deities, which are often called Orisha. And below them are the beings commonly known as the ancestors, who are basically both the recent and the ancient dead. And some of them may move up to become Orisha. And then humans are a step further down from the ancestors, and there are several different levels among humans in terms of how people are understood to relate to each other. And at first, in the very beginnings of this planet, the earth was too wet for habitation, and so several Orisha were sent to harden the surface and create dry land. And after this, Olodumare created the sun, as the Orisha on Earth were creating figurines out of the soil. And after those figurines baked in the sunlight for a while and became solid, Olodumare blew the breath of life onto them and brought people into existence. And reincarnation is also central to how the Yoruba understand humanity, often into the same family lines. The Maasai of East Africa, commonly particularly centered in Kenya, are reluctant to share their cosmology with outsiders, and really, who can blame them? Not me. But their cosmology is reflected in several of their public practices. For example, their calendar is based on a recurring cycle of between 14 to 15 years as each new generation of warriors comes of age, and important decisions are made by the elders of the tribe. The elders, for especially important or difficult decisions, will consult diviners whose oracles cannot lie, but also rarely give clear or simple answers. And their central deity who created the universe is called Enkai and is androgynous, not using male or female pronouns. And Enkai's name means rain. And the Maasai do not believe in an afterlife or reincarnation. And then the Congo of Central Africa divide the universe into the realm of the living and the realm of the dead, which are separated from each other by water. The dead do have an afterlife, but there is no reincarnation. And the land of the dead is understood as the primary source of power in the universe. And so interacting with it is necessary for the living through ritual. And they interact both with the most powerful figure among the dead, who is also the creator of the physical universe of the living, known as Nzambi Mpongu, and several lesser powers who are often called nature spirits, who also live there.
Interesting. Also, if any of this sounds a little bit familiar from the Black Panther, it is because some of the ways that Wakandan culture and peoples were depicted in the movies particularly were based on the Maasai people, particularly the connection that they make is to the Maasai people in what is now Kenya and Tanzania, but then also the Basotho in what is known as Lesotho and the Ovahimba in what is now Namibia and the Mersey in what is now Ethiopia, as well as the Zulu. And we'll link to an article that kind of digs more into that, because they were really intentional in making Black Panther in connecting it to actual African cultures and communities. And so I think that kind of gives some interesting parallels, because as you were talking about particularly the Yoruba, I was like, I wonder, and then the Maasai as well. And I was like, I wonder what Wakanda was based off of.
Yeah. And we do have lots more pop culture conversations coming up, too.
Yes, that was one that we had not included. They do have some cosmology in terms of ancestors and what happens after you die, and also the purple flower.
Yes, in the movie. I'm sure that there's more in the comics, but I have not managed to explore that chunk of comics yet. There are so many of them. So
yeah, I like comics. I just haven't dug into them quite as much. Yeah. But yeah, so there's lots, and it's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then I was digging into Chinese cosmologies, and obviously China is a very, very large country with a lot of different people. And so most ancient cosmology in what we know as China was established during what is called the Warring States period, which was from about 330 to 221 BCE, before Common Era. And a lot of it is connected to and based on like the sun, the moon, and the planets, five of the planets: Venus, which represents metal, Jupiter, which represents wood, Mercury, which represents water, Mars, which represents fire, and Saturn, which represents earth, as a kind of elemental connections, mm-hmm. as well as 28 constellations. And that aspect of it gets more into astrology, which we will cover in an upcoming episode, so circle back around to that. But within Chinese culture, there are multiple contradictory myths and stories, and so one of the most common that has continued into today is that the world was created on Chinese New Year, and that in that 15-day period, animals, people, and many deities were all created. And then other types of Chinese cosmology, it's been interesting looking at cosmologies because there are definite overlaps with different ones. And so mm-hmm. one of the cool things about Chinese cosmology is that there's a lot of shared themes. So the idea of creation out of chaos is something that we find in the Chinese cosmology around the Hundun, which is a kind of primordial and central chaos, and fits within a world egg cosmology where like an egg is hatched to create the world kind of thing, which is similar to the Hawaiian cosmology around Kumulipo. And then another Chinese cosmology that is shared with others is the idea of like a dismembered corpse of a primordial being or deity that then creates earth and all of that. And so in Chinese culture and history, the Pangu in the 3rd century of the Common Era, so this is a more recent cosmology, was semi-divine and was the first human, and that's who separated the Hundun into heaven and earth that we talked about. So the creation from chaos that was an older cosmology then also got added onto, and that happens with a lot of different cosmologies, and we'll talk about that when we get further on as well. But that also connects to Indo-European cosmologies around the Yemo and the Mesopotamian understanding and interpretation of Tiamat, which I don't know about UK, but I learned about it in seminary when we were learning in like our Hebrew Bible classes.
I honestly think the first place I ever encountered Tiamat was probably D&D, but yes, I believe we also did talk about it in Hebrew Bible classes.
Okay, that's fair. I did Hebrew Bible before D&D, so.
Technically, so did I, but I did research into D&D first.
Ah, and then another kind of type of cosmology is a world parent sibling kind of thing, where within Chinese culture, the Nuwa formed people from, I think it's pronounced Loes, but it's a windblown dust or silt kind of material and mud. And it started out and it was just her. And then later, Fuxi was added into that. And so then it was that she procreated with her brother / husband, Fuxi, to create the world. So there's, again, an adding in. Mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting, and this will come up again, that we're adding in a male into the creation that is from what is assumed to be a woman or a female god deity. And so I think that that's an interesting pairing. And another world parent sibling that kind of creation story is the Japanese story of the Izanagi and Izanami. And so that's, again, the similarities across cultures. Obviously, China and Japan are a lot closer than, you know,
China and Mesopotamia
or China and Hawaii.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to see the ways that those ideas work together and are repeated across different cultures and communities. And the last kind of shared theme is that of a dualistic cosmology. And so that's where, when we talk about the yin and the yang, that's kind of how it works. And that I'm going to get into in a minute because it's more complicated than most Westerners interpret it to be. But also the Zoroastrian Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainyu, which I might be mispronouncing, are another kind of dualistic cosmology. And we'll get more into Zoroastrianism and that in our next episode. So yeah, stay tuned for that. And then, so as we know, China has multiple religions, multiple cultures. So some of the like kind of big ones that we maybe have heard of a little bit in Western cultures are the traditions around the qi, which is known as the like air, breath, life force. A lot of cultures have like water as the initial thing, and in a lot of Chinese cosmology, the qi is the initial like most basic element, and it embodies cosmic energy governing matter, time, and space. And according to Taoism and the Tao Te Ching, which is the foundational document for Taoism, which was created before the 4th century BCE, the initial state of the cosmos was featureless and silent. And then from that came the qi. And the qi is unity. And that unity then gives birth to the duality that we experience as the concept of yin and yang. And so it's connected to the qi and emerging from the qi, which emerged from the nebulous void, right? And then that duality gives birth to a trinity, which gives birth to a full diversity. And so I think it's interesting because so often we think of yin and yang as a duality or as a binary. And this kind of resists that interpretation, that it's not just that there's two and A plus B equals one, but that the unity births more and more diversity. And we see that even in the symbol that is used for a yin and a yang, that there's a little bit of each in the other. So I really like that. And I think if you are interested in a book that explores particularly yin and yang from a young adult dystopia kind of perspective, the Iron Widow series is a really great book that kind of digs into this aspect of like Chinese culture and particularly like the yin and the yang and that balance. Yeah. So it's a sci-fi retelling of the rise of Wu Zetian, the only female emperor in Chinese history.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the indigenous cosmologies of Turtle Island, also known as the Native Americans. So again, we've already talked about this with both Africa and China. All creation stories and cosmologies are local and are specific to each tribe or group or culture. And so you can occasionally make a generalization between a couple of tribes or cultures, but you really can't make any about all of them. So I will be talking about some through lines that span multiple cultures, you know, three, four, more. But I can't necessarily say that this is true for all Native American cosmologies.
Which is, when we say Turtle Island, that's one of those examples that, like,
yeah, not all has adopted, Native Americans has been use adopted. That phrase. And so, for example, both the Zuni people of what is now the American Southwest and the Mayans agreed that the universe can be essentially divided into three realms or levels. The lower realm beneath the surface of the earth, the middle realm that we live in on earth's surface, and the upper realm of what's in the skies. And a culture's cosmology influences not only their practices of astronomy, but also their calendar and concepts related to how people think of geography and the cardinal directions. And so the way that they talk about moving in different directions or the meanings of certain places will get influenced by all of this quite often. Another common through line that occurs in multiple cultures is the idea that the being or beings who created the universe that we live in are often referred to as ancestors or relatives of modern people. Perhaps not exactly traceable on a family tree that you can, you know, date back, but very much you're not talking about a untouchable, ineffable being that has nothing in common with humanity. The Zuni and Lakota and several other tribes share that in common. And I know I ran into this a lot when I was in public school talking about Native Americans, but Europeans often have referred to an aspect of Native cosmology as animism, or you could translate that sort of as lifeism, everything is alive, sort of. The concept that all things are alive in different ways, or the vast majority of things are alive in different ways, such as the idea that the earth is a being itself. And now that is commonly referred to as Mother Earth. The feminine pronouns are a common choice for that due to Earth's connection to life springing up. And so while the Europeans often used this term of animism in a pejorative way, they also noted that this approach resulted in a common reaction among the native peoples of an attitude of gratefulness towards the universe around them and how they approach the universe and their relationship with it.
Yeah. When I was in Ecuador in seminary, I did a January term class in Ecuador, and Pachamama was the name for like that Mother Earth.
Yeah.
And it was just really interesting to see the way that that was incorporated, even today, where Catholicism has taken over so much, but that it was in many ways incorporated into people's Christianity or Catholicism if they move towards that. Yeah.
And different tribes also sometimes shared legends of how certain important aspects of life, such as certain plants or animals, came to be. And the Shawnee, Sauk, Fox, and a few other tribes share a story that when a beautiful woman sent by the Great Spirit arrived on Earth from the sky, two hunters fed her. And in gratitude, a year later, she shared what we now call corn, also known as maize, beans, and tobacco with humanity. Which is how those came into being.
And then we get into Babylonian and their predecessor Sumerian cosmologies. And this is the place where we start to see more similarities with the ancient world that the Bible finds itself in. Mm-hmm. And not just similarities, but also like particular differences and more intentional differences, because this is a context in which parts of the Bible were written. So for Babylonian cosmology, the earth and the heavens were round or circular, with references to like a circumference of heaven and earth and the totality of heaven and earth, that there was like a sense of that. And we hear a little bit of that when we talk about the dome in the sky in Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not actually geocentric. So it wasn't like centered on the earth. That was something that was established later by Aristotle's On the Heaven. And there was thought to be multiple heavens and earths. So there are some second millennium BCE Sumerian incantations that refer to there being seven heavens and seven earths, possibly connected to seven generations of the deities, of gods. And the Sumerian religion and culture heavily influenced Babylonian, Hurrian, Akkadian, Assyrian, and other ancient Middle Eastern culture groups who kind of came out of that. Mm-hmm. So looking more specifically at Sumerians' cosmology, they believed that the universe came about through multiple cosmic births, such as gods. So, for example, Nammu was the primeval waters, which gave birth to Ki, the earth, and An, the sky, who then mated together and produced a son named Enlil, and Enlil separated heaven from earth and claimed the earth as his domain. So if you're listening and you're familiar with Genesis 1, you might hear some similar wording. And obviously this is like translations and translations and translations, but that idea of separating heaven and earth and making domes and spheres and that sort of a thing, definitely there is a sense of in which Genesis 1 comes as a response to this dominant cosmology of the time. And then within that belief, humans were believed to have been created by Anki or Enki, which is the son of An and Ki, the earth and the sky. And heaven was actually just a place for gods. When humans died, no matter what they were like when they were alive, their spirits went to Kruer, which was ruled by the goddess Ereshkigal. And later, Ereshkigal was believed to rule alongside her husband Nergal, the god of death. So again, adding in a masculine deity where there's already an established feminine deity. And Kruer, which is K-U-R, is thought to be a cold, dark cavern deep beneath the earth where the only food available was dry dust. So when we talk about Sheol and the dust of Sheol and that sort of a thing, again, there are these connections that we don't know how much was connected, how much was intentionally borrowed or not intentionally borrowed or intentionally resisted, but there are definite parallels that we can notice with the creation accounts in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, absolutely. And then finally, a cosmology that even if you don't immediately recognize this, you probably are at least a little familiar with the concept, or it's going to sound awfully familiar to you, because this is the ancient Greece cosmology of the celestial spheres. And they are a system of understanding the universe that can be traced back to ancient Greece well before Plato and Ptolemy, the Egyptian pharaoh, although both of those are now commonly associated with the system of celestial spheres. Their names go along with that system quite often. And this system was followed and adapted by various philosophers and scientists, including Pythagoras and Aristotle, and I noted throughout my looking through this cosmology system, it does very specifically leave no room for a flat earth theory at all, because it's kind of hard to have a flat earth when you are just a system of spheres. But
what?
I couldn't help but notice that as I was poking through.
Yeah, I always wonder where we really got that from.
So the basic concept dates back earliest to a philosopher of ancient Greece named Anaximander, who was well before Plato, and he thought of the universe as a system of cylinders set within each other, little cylinders inside of a bigger cylinder inside of a bigger cylinder and so forth. And later on, it was actually Plato's student, Eudoxus, who came up with the theory that the universe is a set of spheres, each nesting inside each other like Russian nesting dolls.
Yes, I love Russian nesting doll models.
Yes. And this is not, don't think of it as like a pomegranate that contains many different seeds inside of it. Instead, each sphere contains one slightly smaller sphere, contains one slightly smaller sphere, contains one slightly smaller. That's supposed to be part of the system's perfection, that it's not, you know, 87 spheres in this sphere and 47 spheres in the next sphere and so forth. It's just one sphere inside of each. And this system for Eudoxus had Earth at the very center as the smallest sphere, and then our atmosphere was sort of the next out, and then each planet is in its own sphere with some stars scattered around in that sphere as well, and each sphere could rotate freely, so the next sphere outside of the atmosphere would be the sphere with the moon in it, and then each planet in it is in its own sphere working its way out. The sun was like four spheres out, because ancient Greeks knew that Mercury and Venus could pass between Earth and the sun, and so on, but not between Earth and the moon. So that actually all does work in this system. And the spheres being able to rotate explained why the stars and the planets would move around in our sky. And Aristotle expanded on this idea in his book Metaphysics, in which he elaborates on a rather complicated system of several dozen spheres, somewhere around 50 or so, depending on exactly which part of the book you're looking at. And this theory lasted for centuries and was referenced and adapted by such different people as Roger Bacon, the Jewish rabbi commonly known as Rambam, and Dante, who wrote the Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso, as well as several Muslim astronomers of the Middle Ages who each had their own spin, you might say, to put on it. But Copernicus was actually the guy who changed the system massively in the 16th century by moving the sun to be the central sphere rather than the earth. So changed it from geocentric to solcentric. And that was a big controversy at the time. And a few decades later, one of the very first scientists to just throw out the system completely and say, no, like, none of this is right, we have to start over, was Tycho Brahe, who was studying comets, which frankly kind of, you know, shatters the sphere theory, because comets would move through all of them, and that's not how that was supposed to work.
Yeah.
And while the Bible does not actually bring up this cosmology exactly, there are many well-known classical theologians that followed this system. In fact, quite a lot of them. There are very few that didn't reference it at least once. John Calvin's commentary on Genesis 1 references it quite clearly. And if you've ever heard the hymn, "This is My Father's World," you may also remember that it includes a line about the music of the spheres, which is a reference to this idea of how the universe works as well. So we are nerds at church, and we thought we should include some pop culture cosmologies too.
Some more pop culture, because I can't help myself.
Yes, only in the best ways. And so I thought I would kick off with the cosmology of Skyrim, which, to be honest, is super weird and layered and complicated, and I can't fully explain. But I can tell you that the sun and moons in Skyrim are not, in fact, other planets. Instead, they are magic shining through holes poked in reality by various lesser deities bouncing between this physical realm, which is called Nirn, and the realm of magic called Aetherius. And each race has a separate afterlife that they can go to once they die, although sometimes people can choose which afterlife to go to depending on what deity they choose to follow in life. And there are also a bunch of beings in Skyrim that there are several books about in the game, called Aedra and Daedra. And these are immensely powerful magic users who eventually became lesser gods. And the Aedra are generally benevolent to mortals, and the Daedra are more complicated. They are also known as Daedra princes. And prince in this way is actually a unisex term, because these beings are beyond gender, although many do choose a set of pronouns for mortals to use for them, but they're all known as princes. There are no Daedra princesses. And some of the Daedra are outright malignant, and some of them aren't. It's not really about whether they're kind or mean to mortals. It's really more that they each just have their own agenda and set of things they want to do, and they expect the mortals who worship or work for them to carry out that agenda, and they don't actually care about most other mortals very much at all, for the most part. There are a couple who, because of what they want to do, they sound pretty benevolent. Like, there's one Meridia who is very much against the undead and is in favor of getting rid of those. And, well, you know, vampires and the Draugr and various other undead creatures tend to hurt a lot of mortals in Skyrim. And so she's generally seen as fairly benevolent. But man, if you try to raise the undead around her, she will not be benevolent to you at all.
Interesting.
The Daedra really wind up sounding remarkably human in some ways.
That's fair. That's fair. It's interesting because a lot of my pop culture is like very US, not US based, but like contemporary reality based or future dystopias. So I was thinking about like the X-Men, and theirs is more or less like the same. It's just the next evolutionary step.
Sure.
But of course, I would be remiss, particularly as a co-host of Horror Nerds at Church, if I did not talk about Star Wars. And Pace and I actually covered the Clone Wars TV show season 3 episodes 15 through 17 on our BooTube for our Patreon on Horror Nerds at Church, which really gets into it. But there's this Force lore around, there's this other planet that has a father, a son, and a daughter. And it's amazing how many Trinitarian images are and like interpretations are in Star Wars. But the father is the one who holds the balance between the son, who is the dark side, and the daughter, who is the light side. And it is like from that that the Force and the universe is born and stuff. And the father comes back in Star Wars Rebels, that show. But it was an interesting thing to like look at the balance and then like what happens when it's out of balance and how that works.
Yeah. And then in the Star Trek universe, in Diane Duane's novel Spock's World, which a lot of Star Trek writers, ever since it was written in 1989, have treated as canon and have said so out loud, it is mentioned in that book that the Vulcans have logically determined the existence of God, and then it's not explained. It's actually just a throwaway line. I love Diane Duane so much. And various things arise out of that in the book and throughout her other novels featuring Vulcans, but I really appreciated that. Also in Star Trek, stellar cartography is a known discipline, basically the mapping of the stars, which definitely has a lot to do with cosmology. And at various points in the Star Trek universe, both time and space get weird in different ways, and I can't even begin to go into that list of things, but not everything is always the same, certainly. So, or predictable.
Truth, yeah. Speaking of timey-wimey, I feel like the assumption is that Doctor Who has this, and Doctor Who digs into a bunch of other like assumptions and stories and stuff about origins, but doesn't necessarily have like one unifying or unified cosmology.
Yeah, and the Gallifreyans don't seem to have one, or at least that we hear about.
Yeah, yeah. The like closest we get is the battle between the Time Lords and the Daleks, giving rise to just one Time Lord who comes to Earth.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make sense as like a real giant cosmology of the whole cosmos. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorite book series is the Ember in the Ashes series by Saba Tahir. And if you're in the beginning, you won't, like, the cosmology is kind of explained later in the later books, but the Meherja, who is also known as the Nightbringer, the origin is that Meherja wakes up in the glow of a young world when man knew of hunting but not tilling, of stone but not steel. It smelled of rain and earth and life. It smelled of hope. And then the Meherja is told, "Arise, beloved," by Mouth, who is a voice laden with millennia beyond my ken, the voice of a father, a mother, a creator, and a destroyer, the voice of Mouth, who is death himself. And so Mouth is like the one who creates and brings to life Meherja, who is a djinn, and serves Mouth, helping spirits of those who have died pass on. And then eventually Meherja and Raymat hook up and become partners. And Raymat was a wanderer, and she used to go all over and all of that stuff. And then they settle into this one place in the Forest of Dusk, and have a family. And so they have like this whole family and community and culture of djinn, mm-hmm. who help human spirits pass. And then with their like secrets, and then scholar humans come and are like, "We want all the knowledge," and trick them into giving the knowledge, and then the scholar humans like kill most of them and imprison the other ones, and it's downhill from there. But that like origin of like the symbiosis of different creatures, and particularly the djinn, I really like.
Yeah. And then, of course, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams contains actually a bunch of cosmologies, because he has throwaway lines about a whole bunch of different planets and cultures. But one of my favorites is the Jatravartid people of Vodal 6 firmly believe that the entire universe was sneezed out of the nose of a being called the Great Green Arkle Seizure. And they live in perpetual fear of the time they call the coming of the Great White Handkerchief.
I forgot about the Great White Handkerchief.
Yes.
I love it. So there are so many more pop culture cosmologies. We would love to hear what your favorite cosmologies are, or what cosmologies we're missing from our list. So let us know on all the socials, or send us an email. And if you send us an email, we might read your email on air, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what we do is we connect all things nerdery to the Bible and to our faith. And so we also wanted to dig into some of the cosmologies in the Bible. And this is not as deeply taught as a lot of other biblical stuff. And so, yeah, so be gentle with yourself if this is the first time that you are hearing this. And we're happy to talk more about it. So let us know if this was the first time you heard about any of this. But the first creation account that we have in the Bible is from Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 4a. And this is the one that we know a lot of, that is read at Easter vigils. We've talked about it a bunch on the podcast because it comes up a couple different times. I think it just recently, like the first five verses came up. And in Genesis 1, the kind of question and the thing that it's addressing is that creation happened purposefully, that there was an order to creation. And the writer for this part of Genesis is the priestly writers. And we know this because they emphasize the 7 days, and the seventh day is the day of rest, which is the Sabbath, which is really important to the priestly class. And the word for God that they use is Elohim, as opposed to the Tetragrammaton. So those are kind of some of the hints that we have that this is the priestly writers. But this is the creation account that has 7, quote-unquote, days of creation, though if we look at 2 Peter 3:8 and a couple other places in the Bible that I could not find in my like quick Google search, but I know it's somewhere in the Psalms, there's an understanding that like God's time and our time is not the same, right? So a day for God could be 1,000 years. 1,000 years could be a day. So when we say 7 days of creation, we're not talking about 7 24-hour periods per se.
Right.
And it starts with a formless void and darkness. And then on the first day, light is created. And then the second day is water. And the third day is land and plants. The fourth day is stars and the moon, or the lesser light, and the sun, the greater light, and then creatures of the water and the air, then land creatures, and then finally humankind, who is made. And this is the part where we get the, I'm just gonna like read the verses because I think they're just so beautiful. And this account is really poetic in the repetition and in the, and there was evening and there was morning.
Mm-hmm.
Whichever day. So God created humankind in their image. In the image of God, they created them. Male and female, between and beyond, God created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And then goes on from there. But I love this God creating the diversity within humanity. And then also like in God's image, and the only image we have of God right now is of creator. And so like that idea that creativity is a way that we bear the image of God.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the final day, God rests. And therefore, we also rest on the Sabbath.
Also other days.
The other kind of purpose of this. And other days. You can rest on more than just the Sabbath. But the purpose of this was to say that you definitely rest on the Sabbath.
Yes. Naps are good for you.
If God can do it, you can too.
And you can't actually say that about everything.
It's true. It's true. It's true. But the like not working,
yeah.
If God can take a break from work, you are not that important that you cannot also.
Yeah. So the beginning of Genesis then includes a second account of creation, which is separate, which starts in the second half of the fourth verse of the second chapter and continues through verse 25. And in this version of the creation story, there's an emphasis on how humans are important to God. And so the humans play a much bigger role in this story than in the first one. And this account was written by the Yahwist writers, as they're known, which is mostly because rather than using the term Elohim for God, they tended to use the Tetragrammaton, which is transliterated into English as YHWH. And in this version of the story, God's power is especially emphasized and important.
Mm-hmm.
And so this story starts with Earth and the heavens with a stream. And God formed a human from humus, or a earthling from the earth. And God breathes life into them. And then God plants Eden, including every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, plus the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then Eden's river stretches out past the garden and becomes the Pishon, Gihon, Tigris, and Euphrates. And all of those are actually like still on maps today in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And the human is told that they can eat anything except for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I'm fairly certain they can't eat from the tree of life either, right?
No, in verse 16, God commands, you may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall die. Saying they could eat of the tree of life because they were
staying alive
and stuff.
Yes,
and then
okay.
They can't after the whole...
After they leave the garden.
Yeah.
Yes, that makes sense, because there's only the one. Yeah, so, okay, so I always get that part of the story mixed up myself, obviously, but...
Which, you know, happens. Everybody gets parts of the story mixed up. That's why we're here, and we do this in relationship, which is one of the things that I forgot to write down, that is also emphasized in this story, that humans are intended to be in relationship.
There. Just give me a second.
Okay, sorry.
Speaking of relationship. And so God searches for a partner for the human by making all sorts of different animals, and the human names the various animals, presumably the species as well as like individual names, I like to think. And then God gives up on making an animal that can partner with the human. And so God puts the human to sleep and takes out a rib. And now there is a man and a woman who are bone of my bone / flesh of my flesh for each other. And they were naked and not ashamed. And the story continues from there.
Yes. The story continues in ways that have lots of problematic interpretations, but we're not going to that part.
I mean, there are plenty of problematic interpretations of both of the creation accounts while we're at it, but we're not going into those either.
It's true. It's true. But it is important, like, especially if this is the first time that you're hearing that there's more than one creation account in the Bible. One of the things that I like to emphasize is that these are people sharing their stories and then different peoples coming together to form larger and larger communities. And so finding the commonalities in their stories, and these two stories tell different things. They answer different questions about creation and about God and about humanity, right? That's why we say that creation happened purposefully for Genesis 1 and that human relationship was important for Genesis 2, because those have different focuses.
Yeah.
Foci, if you will.
And while we're at it, the ancient Israelites put a big emphasis on, if we have different ideas about them, we should write all of them down. Which is why we have two creation accounts, which is why we have four Gospels, which is why we have the books of Chronicles and the books of Kings, which tell two different versions of the same set of stories. So when in doubt, write it all down was their theory, and it works out pretty well for us in the long run.
Yeah, I think it's much better than when in doubt or conflict, pick one and kill the other person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or banish. So another space of cosmology in scripture is Psalm 104, which is a psalm of praise that gives this beautiful and poetic account of God creating the cosmos and how it is structured today, from stretching out the heavens like a tent and setting the beams of God's chambers on the waters, to springs gushing forth in the valleys, wild asses quenching their thirst, to the lofty abode from which God waters the mountains. And one of the things that I love about this one is that it specifically includes the line, "And Leviathan that you formed to sport in it," which is like basically a giant water monster. I don't know.
Yes.
Loch Ness? Who knows? But Leviathan. Scary water monsters are real.
Yeah. And then we have Job chapter 38. Job is actually very possibly the oldest book of the Bible, written the earliest, and is an ancient parable of God's relationship with humanity. And in this story, God made a bet about whether or not Job would turn on God when faced with enough suffering. And so finally, in chapter 38, Job has finally reached the level of complaining about God, and God shows up in this chapter and is basically saying, "Oh yeah, did you do all of this?" And then lists out a poetic and powerful cosmology, including the creation of land and seas, stars and heavens, snow and rain, and a whole bunch of other stuff. All the things that God has created. Actually, it goes on a little longer than chapter 38, but it is definitely the whole of chapter 38 plus some. So
yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
But it's really gorgeous.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out if there was a Leviathan in this account. I feel like there is.
I think there is some kind
of the deep or something.
Gigantic animal. Yes, referenced. But
yeah,
I don't know about Leviathan in particular.
Yeah. But also, this is not the only time there's cosmology in the Bible, even, right?
No.
There's in Proverbs, we hear of woman wisdom who was at the beginning with God. And in the Gospel of John, the beginning of John is this very poetic connection to woman wisdom. And we talk about that in a previous episode that we'll link to as well. But they have these wonderful and amazing ways of connecting to creation and connecting to this like kind of big cosmos, Jesus as the word and the light of the world kind of sense.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
Absolutely. And now for our Muppets moment. If each Muppet made their own universe, whose universe would you want to live in and what do you think it would be like?
This one's easy for me. I'm apparently on a Fozzie Bear kick, but I pick Fozzie Bear. All the puns.
It's going to be entertaining.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. I love Fozzie Bear, and I want all the puns, and I think it would be hilarious and delightful, and I probably would need to run away at some points because I'm an introvert, but I do think it would be just, like, filled with delight, which I love.
Yes. For myself, I admit I am torn between the universe that Rolf would create, because he would make a universe full of music and warmth, and I think that would just be lovely.
He would.
But also, I am attracted to the universe that Miss Piggy would create, because I just know that her universe would get rid of so much of the annoying stuff that I have to deal with in everyday life.
Oh my gosh.
And she
I
would
didn't
not put
think
up
about
with any
that.
Of that stuff. And I am delighted by that. And so, I am torn.
I didn't... I didn't think about that, and I love it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I would definitely be here for that. Mm-hmm. What about you all? Whose universe do you want to live in, and what do you think it would be like? Let us know. And thanks for joining us for our first episode of the season.
Yeah.
Our theme music was by Rachel Meyer Lachlan. Our Muppets music was by Brenda Boss. And our seasonal artwork was by Pace Warfield. Catch us next time when we'll dive into the Magi and Zoroastrianism. This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing and Kay Roloff. For more fun, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Blue Sky at Nerds at Church. Or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut episodes, merch discounts, movie commentaries, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. Starting at just $5 a month, it's cheaper than creating your own universe. By a lot.
I mean, for real.
I hope. Yeah.
That'd be expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, even just like literarily creating your own universe. That takes time, effort, pages, ink.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or even if you're just using toothpicks and marshmallows, which is the last thing that my confirmation students chose to build with. But
I love that. I want to make a cosmos out of toothpicks and marshmallows.
It doesn't last very long, I'll tell you that much.
That's fair. That's fair. Also, let us know on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter which Muppets universe you want to live in and what you think it would be like.
As the ancient Christians said,
Pax vobiscum.